then. He's co-written and co-directed the mock Broadway hit Jerry Springer, the opera, and has been a regular political pundit on TV, amongst many other things. He's heading to Derby on the 30th of this month with his stand-up show ahead of a brand new TV series he's got coming up on BBC Two. If you've seen the previous series, you know he's a curmudgeonly old so-and-so, isn't he? So how close is the person we see on the TV to the real one?
It's sort of an exaggerated version of lots of things about me that I really realised it at first, and it's increasingly helpful to make that separation. I mean, you know, I am sort of politically liberal to left of centre, but I exaggerate it to see where that gets you to. You know, for comic effect, I'm aware I do have a kind of a boredom and an irritation with most of popular culture, but I do exaggerate that. For comic effect, I'm aware that I've got slightly snobbish tendencies that I try and keep in check, but I don't worry about that for the stage persona. So, you know, I mean, it's sort of it's an exaggerated version of lots of things about me, and not necessarily things that I like either.
Do you know where the line is on the ground these days? You like to push it a little and get across that.
Yeah,
is that going
off
in the back of your head?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it's easier to do that because more people are coming along that know who you are and get the joke. On the other hand, you get on telly, your name sort of floats about a bit, and the people come to see you that don't know what they're coming to, and that's really good fun as well, because it means you've got to work with their perception. So, you know, it's all good.
I think one of the last times I saw you when you came to Derby, I was just coming into the Assembly Rooms car park.
Oh, yeah.
And you were off around to the Exeter with Richard for a drink.
What, like 20 years ago?
Another age. Another you as well. And you've moved on from all of that. Do you look back on that with affection or not?
Well, you know what, right? I'd done stand-up before doing the double act, and I was always doing it while we were doing the double act. But we did such a lot of work on the double act in the mid-90s, on the Lee and Herring double act, that actually it's almost like burned out of my memory, you know. And just recently we found out that we made two series for the BBC in the mid-90s, and we found out they were going to throw them all away, all the tapes, so we bought them back off them. And tried to release them ourselves, and we had to sit and watch them all to do the commentaries. And I really enjoyed it, and I'd sort of forgotten ever writing any of it, which it must have seemed really vain and arrogant. We're sitting there going, "Ah, that's funny," but it's your own stuff from 20 years ago. But it was like someone else had written it. You know, I can't really remember it. I can't remember the circumstance. I mean, in many ways, it was a very frustrating period because it was. You know, when they in the mid-90s, they sort of started saying comedy was the new rock and roll. You know, remember that?
Mm.
And we were sort of put out on the road in the way you'd put a rock and roll band out, which meant we went off for months and months and came back in debt. But we had big riders and nice hotel rooms. And when I got out the other side of that, I thought, this is just, you can't live like this. It's insane. You know, so I was getting into my mid-30s and I was still broke. So I started kind of... Running it all in a much more cost-effective way and stripping everything back and doing all my own admin and driving and everything. And then things started to turn around a bit. So although I'm proud of the work that I did in that period in the double act, the actual experience of it was, I mean, you look back on it and you think, what the hell was going on, really? You know, it's weird.
But does it make you grow up?
I've got management again now, and I've got promoters for tours, but there was a great period about 10 years back where I sort of did a lot of stuff, and it does help you understand how it all works, and it is worth understanding how it all works. And I remember 20 years back, my then girlfriend's sister was going out with a bloke in a band that had just got signed, you know, during the Britpop era, one of them sort of Oasis-y type groups. And I remember he got given an advance, and he went, "Oh, brilliant, I've got an advance," and he went off and bought all these. He bought loads of shirts and bikes and things, and I was going, do you understand what an advance is? You know, that's like you're now in debt to this record company, and you've got to earn that back. Of course, they never did, and he was just carrying this terrible debt. I don't think it's really explained to people that it's not like, you know, when you in a dressing room, you see, you know, like bands go in, or a comic might go in, "Oh, there's a bottle of wine here and loads of sandwiches." Well, that's coming off your bill, you know, and you can sometimes the profit margin on a gig can be the cost of four cans of lager and a plate of sandwiches, you know. So it's sort of, you have to kind of get a grip on it.
Assembly Rooms on the 30th of January, and he's talking about his comic history. He does stand up, he's been part of a double act, he's done lots of different things on the radio and on TV as well. So could he be a manager then, to a new artist?
No, absolutely not. Because you know what? That's the weird thing now. I get asked to go and do talks at colleges or to students or all sorts of things about writing and performing and whatever. And you can talk about the theory of it and how you have ideas. But the economics of this country are so different 25 years ago when I started. If someone's been to college and they want to become a comic or a writer or whatever, they might be trailing a 30 grand debt, which they wouldn't have been 25 years ago. Their rent is disproportionately much more expensive than ever it was. All the little safety nets we had of enterprise allowance schemes or going on the dole or all kinds of things are all disappeared. The subsidies for things are gone. You know, all the little things that used to help you be, for want of a better word, an artist, have been stripped away. And there's also this kind of culture now of endlessly deferred payment, you know, people doing internships for nothing. We can't pay you, but you can put your little film on YouTube and maybe someone will watch it. And it's like, it's incredibly difficult. And that's why you see a massive narrowing of focus to just, privileged people. Not that there's anything wrong with them inherently, and I'm probably one. But I mean, I just think you do see a narrowing of focus in people that are in bands or are comedians or a writer or whatever, because probably need some parental money to help you out.
But then eventually it feeds into what your routine might be, what you might want to write about as well. The intelligence and the knowledge that you've got. Do you have to sit down and treat any tour like a job and say, this is the material I'm going to write? Or does it have to come when inspiration hits?
Well, it's a bit of both. I mean, you know, to be honest, I've just finished recording 6 half-hours for BBC Two that will go out in the spring. And two or three of them came instantly. One that came out really well, I did it. I wrote in about 2 hours, honestly. It just hit me and I did it. The other two, I've been like pulling teeth, months and months of rewrites, just to get 1 half-hour right, which was about the property boom. It took me, I wrote about 90 minutes of stuff just to try and find this right half-hour, and I kept chopping and changing it, and two of them didn't really come together until about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, there's all sorts of things you can talk about. I'll sit down, think about this, carry a notebook, do this, try that. But it is just luck as well. And one really good one half-hour that came together really well was, I was thinking about UKIP and immigration policy and stuff like that, and I just heard an interview in the radio when I was in the car and after I dropped my kid off with a guy from UKIP, where he just said one sentence that just clicked it all for me. He said one quite funny, odd sentence, and a half-hour came out of it. You know, and if I hadn't heard that, I wouldn't have got it. And I mean, you can read all these books, and Robert McKee, the American scriptwriting guru, says do this and do that. But sometimes you're just lucky. You just see something or hear something, you know. My wife said something really funny to me about a year ago that became the basis of a half-hour routine. And she wasn't trying to be funny. She didn't know. She didn't know. What she said an incredible, you know, you never know. It's just luck. And the weird thing about now being a dad, I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, is a lot of dad stuff happens to me because I'm looking after the kids, but I'm not going out, I'm not out and about, things don't happen to me in the same way. We don't have sort of adventures or time to passively consume culture, you know, so it's harder to have ideas, really.
Does the wife get a finder's fee or not?
Yes, I assiduously credit every single person that I ever get an idea from at the end of DVDs and on the telly. I'm absolutely scrupulous about it. So she will get a minute. There's going to be two writers credited in this forthcoming 180 minutes of material. She'll get a minute for being rude about my underwear, and my producer will get a minute for saying a funny thing about a Filipino. And that's it. And also a guy from a band called The Heads from Bristol helped me, and Carlton B. Morgan, who's a Welsh cartoonist, they helped me think of the names of 70s progressive rock bands that also sounded like the names of real ales.
Comedy. But what I wanted to ask Stuart about is, sometimes we get people into studios to talk, but we actually gave him a call at home, whether he liked doing interviews. Was it the fact that he didn't want to go out and talk about his comedy?
Well, it's been really nice talking to you, because you've obviously seen stuff I've done, and you've asked me about it. What's difficult is when you're talking to someone who's not seen that you've done, is basically working from a kind of patchwork of Daily Mail hearsay that they've cut and pasted off Google. And then it's really difficult, because you just spend the whole interview in a kind of denial, saying, oh, well, I didn't actually say that, or I've never been there, or I didn't, well, that's not what, you know. And then you look like some kind of miserable, uncooperative curmudgeon. But it is, I mean, if I don't really like doing press. I don't really want to be known as a personality, because as you can hear from talking to me, I'm a reasonable, personable sort of person. And the persona on stage is of a horrible idiot. Who's a belligerent, arrogant man. And I don't really want to undermine that by being known as a person. Also, I don't really want to. I don't like going on things, promote stuff, because I don't like the kids. I don't really want them to suffer because of me. You know, and my 6-year-old already picked on because his parents are comedians, and so you kind of don't want to make their lives any worse by being any better known than you need to be. But I suspect I'm probably talking to you because Derby's not sold as well as they would hope.
Listen, I'm working this as much as I possibly can.
So, you know, but I mean, I think it's weird. We live in a sort of culture now where even an F-list celebrity like me, you're expected to sort of be, you're expected to have a Twitter feed and a blog and to make yourself available. And
but you've got an amazing website, which has got your life on it.
Yeah, I know. Well, I've done that. You know, I put everything up there. And, I don't want to have to be accountable to everyone or to have to be everywhere as a personality. And I think I sort of, you know, when we were kids, right, and someone went on Parkinson, it was like amazing, wasn't it? You never had any idea what these actors were like, and then they'd have this sort of rather defensive chat with him, and it would seem amazing. I miss that in a way, that period where you didn't have to know about everyone all the time. There was some separation between the character, the persona, the work, and the person.
Let people talk.
Yeah, I know.
It's not about the host, is it?
No.
Is that why you avoid doing things like that? Because, you know, you've got plenty of things to talk about. You don't want some inane gag coming halfway through, do you?
Well, I work round things quite slowly, and it seems like on these sorts of programs, you're supposed to talk in a succession of bullet points that, you know, can then be reduced to a 140-character Twitter statement. And I just don't think like that, so I don't think it really suits me, to be honest. So, you know, I just keep out of it. I mean, I could probably sell more tickets if I could go on things like that. But I think the impact on your life is, you know, I mean, my telly shows, they get about 1 million viewers, and most of the people that watch them have actively sought them out. What I've found, if you go on some, I've done 3 panel shows in my life. And then what I found when you do that is, like, if you go on Have I Got News For You, 6 million people see it, and you're getting all, like, weird aggro off people for the next couple of weeks, you know. It's very strange. Like, someone will come up to you in a pub if you've been on Have I Got News For You or something, and they go, oh, you're famous, can I have your autograph? And you go, oh, all right. Then another person comes over and goes, who are you then? Am I supposed to know who you are? Who are you? They go, no one. What, are you famous, are you? Like, in a really aggressive way, like you. But you didn't start it. You know what I mean? It's sort of like your very existence seems to create a problem. And I don't live a life where I'm removed from people and from everyday. I don't want to, and I don't want my kids to have to. So, you know, I try to do enough stuff to sell the shows out. But I don't want my kids to be embarrassed by me, you know.
So. I think you've done more than enough on that for us here at BBC Radio Derby for us today. 30th of January, you're at the Assembly Rooms here, back at the Assembly Rooms. Before that, the 23rd of January, you're in Nottingham at the Playhouse.
Oh, that's right, we're going back for the third time on this tour there. So it's great, that one, yeah.